There's a couple of people we want to thank for supporting our show this month through patreon.com/comicbookclub. So let's hit it, Pete. Daniel Fuentes.
Dan Snow.
Lucas Inc.
Andrew Richardson.
Jeffrey Reicher.
Matthew Wood.
Mitchell McDonald.
Matt Fennell.
Mike Dargenio.
Zika's Viral Comics.
Chuck White.
Chris Weens.
Dennis Scott.
Victor Perez.
W. Blaine.
Demand Ryan.
Curtis LaRock.
Hugo Sanchez.
Jason Kelly.
Michael Sturgeon.
And Trevor Matthew. And a special thank you to Brett McChris for supporting us through our GoFundMe this month. Thank everybody so much for supporting this show.
We really,
and all
really
the shows
appreciate
that
it.
We do. And now, enjoy the live show.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming out to Comic Book Club Live. Please give it up for your hosts, Alex, Justin, and Pete.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And that's our Bad in the Booth, Boothman Prime.
Boothman Prime.
And guys, we have begun the countdown to Avengers Infinity War. Very excited. Everybody's very excited about it. Last week, I had bought tickets. Pete hadn't even thought about
buying. Yeah, Pete doesn't even care about this movie.
He didn't care.
Fuck you.
You don't even know.
I got tickets. Where are you at?
Huh?
Oh, so
where
you
am
did
I
get
at?
Tickets. Yeah. You did get tickets.
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah.
Okay,
I'm going to get tickets like at the theater.
That'll work out great for
I'm
you.
I'm just going to get in line.
Are you going to be the guy and be like, hey, man, you got tickets? You got extra tickets?
Yeah, I'm going to buy tickets from a scalper from a movie theater, which is a great way.
Yeah, you'll be fine. Here's the thing. There's plenty of tickets available.
No.
It's showing in multiple theaters.
Yeah.
Like, a lot.
It's not like Harry Potter and the Cursed Child now on Broadway.
Uh-oh, I feel a sponsorship coming on.
Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Mr. Broadway, Alex Alvin.
The magic has finally come home to the stage.
Now, you're a Harry Potter guy. Are you going to go see that?
Yeah, I'm seeing it this Sunday,
Look
actually.
At you fucker. Great.
And all I had to do was plug it on this show.
It wasn't wildly expensive, and then you have to wait and go again for... To see the second part?
You see it in the same day, but it's wildly expensive twice that way.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Do you know what else is cool is our guest? He's one of my favorite guys to have on the show.
You don't have to pay twice to see him. Only the once.
Yeah, you guys just have to pay once for this free show. He is writing so many comics that we're going to be talking about, but I'm particularly excited because just debuted his first original novel, The Oracle Year. Ladies and gentlemen, Charles Soule!
Yeah!
Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hello.
Have a seat, have a microphone.
How are you doing, sir?
Good. It's nice to be back. I feel like it's been way too long.
Yeah, it has. You've been busy writing a novel or something.
I have written a novel, which took a long time. It's mostly words. In comics, you can make the artist do most of the work.
Mm-hmm.
But in prose and novels, you gotta really do a lot of the heavy lifting.
The artist on this novel must have had a really easy trip.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I got to say that it was very weird that I got to certain pages and it was like, I don't know, we'll just figure it out later, do a splash page or something.
Right.
Not good writing, Charles. Not good writing.
You know, it's the way you make a comic, and I figured I would just try to apply those skills to a novel, and it just didn't work. It was a real drag.
I think the last time we talked to you, we were on a cruise ship.
Oh my God! Is that right?
Yeah. That was like a year ago, maybe.
Yeah, we go on cruises a lot.
Yeah, just the four of us. The four of us.
That was the one and only convention on a cruise ship that I'm aware of.
Don't think that'll be happening again. Just going to throw that out there.
Yep,
we'll see what happens.
Yep, it was super cool. I would do it again.
Yes,
it was very fun. It was an absolute blast. Everybody seemed to. I think all the creators. We just went to the casino at night and went to the bar and went to the pool. Like, we loved it.
I never found the drinks. Was there alcohol there? I didn't actually remember.
You couldn't find alcohol on a cruise ship. Wow.
We've talked about this a bunch of times on the show, but I was there with my family, and we all got on the cruise ship together. I was like, okay, I'll see you guys in a little bit. We dropped off our stuff at the room. By the time I got back to the pool, Pete and Justin had each had six drinks.
What we did was we brought our drinks to the safety meeting where you can't have drinks.
Sure.
So they were like, finish your drinks. And then we were out of ideas.
It was... We got too excited too fast and started drinking.
Did you bring like a rack of shots to the safety meeting?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, we're like, I guess we got it. Well, can't dump them out.
Yeah. Got to be safe.
Real safe.
Mark Wade was in our lifeboat, and he was not happy about it.
Yeah. This is great and definitely what everybody wants to hear on the show. Yes. Instead, though, I'm going to talk about The Oracle Year. This book is so good, Charles.
Thank you so much.
Really creative. It's very fast-paced. The characters are a lot of fun. It's very character-driven. But there's a big concept behind it. Can you pitch
the concept? Sure,
of course.
So the main idea behind The Oracle Year is that there's just sort of an average New Yorker who has essentially a vision of 108 things that are due to happen over the next year. And so they're all in the future. They all have a date and a time associated with them. And then he goes and he kind of writes them all down as soon as he gets out of the vision. And then the first one comes true, and then the second one comes true, and he realizes that he maybe has something. And so the book is about how he releases that information into the world, the remaining predictions, and how the world reacts to the idea that there's a prophet in the world, like somebody who actually can predict the future in a real way, not in a kind of Miss Cleo way, which is a great reference that I'm sure everybody will catch.
I got you.
Yeah, we got it.
All right.
But she predicted that I would be here tonight.
Really?
Wow.
On that phone call, that, you know, $5.99 a minute phone call.
It was very expensive.
It took
correct,
a lot of money until she finally was like, okay, fine, you'll be here tonight.
Do you do a weekly podcast? And she predicted that I would be here again.
So basically, I wanted to explore the idea of kind of, this sounds kind of, you know, but it is a novel, right? You're supposed to be very... big ideas. So it's the idea of the way humanity relates to the future, the way we think about the future, because I think we think about it all the time. It's like everything we do is constantly wondering what's going to happen. You know, I mean,
especially
I don't know if
now.
I don't know if you guys have heard of Twitter.
Nope.
Well, it's a website, which is such a weird, like people say, you know, people call Twitter a website, and it just feels so diminutive. Like, Twitter's not really a website.
Right.
Twitter's this other...
experience, man.
It kind of is. It's something that affects us in a lot of weird ways, Twitter.
That
but
is
regardless,
true.
Right now, I think we're all very preoccupied with, like, literally what is going to happen tomorrow. What are we going to wake up to? And so writing a book that is about the ability to sort of find out what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen in 6 weeks, what's going to happen in your life, what's going to happen to the world, seemed pretty compelling. And I'm very lucky that I started writing this book, and then it came out in a moment when we're also focused on the future.
I was going to ask you about that, because I imagine you've been working on this for a very long period of time.
True.
But it feels very of the moment, particularly without spoiling anything, where the book gets to in the last third or so.
Sure.
I guess that was just a lucky coincidence.
Yeah, sometimes these things just work out that way. I started writing the book, not really writing it, but conceptualizing the book when I was working as an attorney, and I knew that I didn't want to be an attorney. So I was very preoccupied with the idea of, well, all this time I spent going to comic conventions and pitching my books and trying to get a foothold in a creative life, you know, a creative living ever take hold. And so I would have loved to have been able to ask an oracle at that time whether or not it was ever going to work out. And then I thought, well, don't we all have a question like that? That was mine at the time, but I'm sure all three of you have your own version of that, you know, and everyone in the audience has their version of that, and so on and so forth.
Mine was, when are you going to finish this novel?
Well, now you know.
I know.
You got an answer. There
great.
You go.
So how did it come together then? Because you've been writing comics for a while. I mean, you talked about that creative transition just now. That was pretty full-fledged into comic books, and you've been writing a bunch of comic books at a time for a bunch of years now. So how did you finally move it back over to writing this book?
Well, it wasn't like a shift into this direction, right? It was more of a, I'm going to do this along at the same time. And so it was when I could find myself a day that I didn't have to write an issue of, you know, She-Hulk or Wolverines or whatever the book was I was working on, I would take the day and I would write a chapter. And eventually you do that enough times and it turns into a novel. And then I have some people, which is kind of nice.
Uh-huh.
It's nice to have people, right?
People whose
job it is to vet things that I create to see if there might be a reason to take them further. And so they looked at the stuff and they're like, you know, this is really good. And one of them was a literary agent, and he said, well, I think, you know, this is saleable, but I have this note, this note, this note. And so I'm like, okay, cool, I'll get to it. And then comics and life and everything else got in the way. And he came to New York Comic Con and I saw him and we had coffee, and he's like, so where's that revision? I'm like, dude, I'm really busy. Like, I'm writing I don't know. What was I writing then? I don't know. 45 my Daredevil,
comic
yeah, whatever. My Daredevil run just started. And he's like, I might not have been clear. If you get me these revisions, which were not that substantial, like I can sell this book immediately. And so I was like, okay, cool. I didn't understand. And then I went home and I told, you know, I asked my wife if I could take like a week just to do it, like just to disappear. And so I went away and finished it, and I sent it to him, and he sold it in a week. So
wow.
It was yeah, kind of amazing. Amazing.
I would have loved to see your face, and the guy with the agent was like, no, listen, do this. And you were like, fuck.
Yeah. I fucked up so hard. I know. It was months and months I just wasted, but it all worked out.
But yeah. It seems insane, because you were writing so many books, and the fact that while you're writing all these books, a novel comes out just is like, where does this guy find the time?
Well, I don't know. I don't do as many comic book talk shows as I used to.
And that's a huge mistake.
That's a real time suck.
But to be fair, Pete, a lot of this stuff is just like Daredevil pages.
There's a lot of lightsabers,
a lot of Wolverines, a lot of Paul.
Just pasted some stuff.
It was
in
weird
there.
That Wolverine popped in at a certain point. At the end of the book,
word for word dialogue from some of my comics. But you know, you got to get done.
You got to get it done.
So I mean, it sounds like you've been practicing this and working on this all along. But I was curious, just because your main expertise in writing is comic books,
sure.
What were the challenges in writing prose? Was there anything where you felt like you ran into a little bit of a wall or something that...
Yeah, I mean, it was never really a wall exactly. It was more like... I would describe it as... do you guys remember CD stores?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So there was a feeling when you used to walk into a CD store and you were like, man, I know, it, like before you walked into the store, you're like, I know exactly what I want to buy. I know why I'm going to the CD store. And then you walk in and you're faced with this endless choice of thousands of CDs and you can't remember why you walked in there.
That's so funny.
And that is kind of like writing a book or a novel because you have literally infinite ways to describe any scene, any sequence. And it's up to you to decide the very best way for yourself to do that. And once you start overthinking it, it's like you're overthinking the angle to approach it from. Oh, wow. You know, whose perspective should it be from? And so that can be very sort of paralyzing. And in comics, you don't have to worry about that because it's like, all right, the scene takes place on top of an aircraft carrier, and there's a big fight, and you figure it out. And then they make those choices for you. You know, you've chosen the location, but the rest of it. But when you're writing a novel, the entirety of the reader's experience is in your hands and in your mind. And so you have to, you know, just sort of figure it out and decide. And how deeply do you describe that aircraft carrier? Do you describe every plane? Do you describe how many planes there are? Or can you just say, we're on an aircraft carrier, and people have their own vision in their mind? And finding where that needle stops is the art of writing a novel. And it takes a long time to figure it out.
You just wake up days later and you've been in like the Pearl Jam European EP imported
exactly.
Section. You're like, what the fuck am I even doing over here?
Now, you say CD store, but that's what it's like when I go to a comic book store. I have a list and I'm like, I can't, because once you get in there, it's like, oh, I forgot about this book.
Sure, of course.
And like, I used to have to put like money in my sock because I would spend all my money that I had on me. So I would have lie to myself that I didn't have any money.
The money in the sock was the safe place?
Safe place, yeah.
And it was a sock you were wearing, not a sock you left at home?
Yep.
But so you knew you had that money in the sock.
Well, I would be so distracted by the comics, I would just check my wallet.
You forget about
the fact
socks?
That you had a large wad of money stuffed in your sock.
I don't know about a large wad.
It wasn't that large, yeah.
There's like four or five quarters in your...
yeah. Save some money for ramen.
Great. Wow. What a startling vision of Pete's life.
Were there, when you were writing the book, were there any authors in particular you were inspired by? I mean, it reads as your voice, and it feels like the same sort of thing as reading one of your comic books. There were definitely little, and I mean this in a good way, there were little tells where I felt like, oh, okay, I'm reading Charles Soule's novel, not
somebody
else's novel.
That's good.
Yeah, but was there anybody or any books or anything that you kind of looked to for inspiration?
I mean, I would say that, Stephen King and Joe Hill are both big inspirations as far as the way I wanted this to feel. Brad Meltzer's another one. Neal Stephenson's another one. I would say all of those, because when you pick up one of those books, I feel like you're immediately immersed into another world or situation. You really don't want to leave it. And they're all extremely propulsive. Like you just push through it. And that's what I was trying to achieve here. I wanted it to feel like a book that you pick it up and, you know, it's not that it's, I don't think it's like easily dismissed or stupid or anything like that. Like, there's a lot of thought behind it. But at the same time, I wanted it to be a very engaging, awesome experience, like almost like a bingeable book. That's what I was sort of
binge
going for.
Reading. Well, a slightly tangential question, if I could jump in. The cover, to get to the visual side, I feel like this is such an arresting cover, both in person and seeing it online.
Sure.
Did you have any input in that, or how did that work?
The input I had was they sent me, we talked about it, and then they sent me three designs, and I'm like, oh my God, that's it. And normally, these go through many rounds of revisions and sort of tweaks and all that stuff, and I think the only thing we changed was the size of my name on the cover.
Yeah! You made it smaller to respect the book, right?
Yes, absolutely I did. Absolutely I did.
Thank you for admitting that.
Yeah, sure. But the, you know, I brought, I think, a comic book sensibility to it, right? Which is when you go into a comic book store and you see everything racked, the really good covers are the ones that you can pick up from the room.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to mistake this book for anything other than it
100%.
Is.
100%. It's so good.
And what's been great is that, you know, Twitter, we talked about it earlier. You remember that website?
I was on it today. Let me be honest.
You logged on to Twitter.com?
I don't even know how to log off. That's the problem.
That's
I'm always on.
Yep, me too. Yep. And so people take pictures of this book. People picture themselves holding it. People, you know, putting it places because it looks cool.
Yeah.
And it's
putting it places.
Putting it places.
I
yes.
Got you. Yeah.
I haven't gotten one of those yet,
that'd
but I'm sure it's a matter of time.
That'll be a direct message.
I have
something I want to send you.
That'll be a DM. but you know what I mean? Like it's something that's visually interesting, and people like to, you know, like it's gotten a lot of Instagram love, which is kind of great. And right. So yeah. It's I feel like a lot of things have come together really well for it. It just came out last Tuesday, so a week ago, and you know I just hope it stays in people's minds. I don't know, whatever. It's books are so weird. They like, you know, new books came out today, and so mm-hmm. I want to make sure that people are continuing to think about and read my book. But it's a tale, you know, like the tale of distribution is so different in novels because in comics, you know, you sell your books to the comic stores and then they're sold. That's it.
Yeah.
But in novels, every copy of The Oracle Year that has been ordered by a store is returnable. So Amazon,
oh, wow.
Whatever, you know, Barnes & Noble, all the indie bookstores, if they've ordered it, if it's on their shelf, doesn't mean it counts.
Oh,
it only counts
crazy.
When people buy it. And if they don't buy it, they send it back to HarperCollins, and then it's like, whatever,
oh,
that's just
man.
Sort of a sunk cost.
And they hit you with every single one.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah sure. It's like an assembly line. They're just hitting me in the back of the head. So for me, you know, I did this. It's the job you do in comics, which is the sort of, you know, ramp up the pre-orders, get as many people to order it as possible, mm-hmm. and then it is what it is. But in novels, it's both. You have to make sure that the bookstores order it and want to put it on their shelves. Amazon does whatever they're going to do, like everything. And then once it's out, you then have to do it all again to talk to the consumers directly, which is awesome, right? I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
It's something I feel like I have, you know, I like doing it, but it's... You know, like I'm only halfway there at this point.
Right. It keeps you, you're just constantly doing it. So it must be just an ongoing.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you follow me on Twitter, but it's literally all I've been talking about for weeks and weeks, which I know is kind of a drag. But
now, I'm not going to get into any spoilers, but there's a lot of ideas that you throw out in the book. And there are some things that I do feel like are a little open ended. Do you feel like because you have written comics, you are in this sequential mindset, do you feel like you left things open on purpose just to potentially continue the story?
Well, there's the biggest question in the book that I intentionally didn't answer, and I don't want to spoil anything for readers because I assume that everyone who listens to this will go pick it up.
Definitely.
But there's I made decisions based on not sequels, mm-hmm. but what I thought this book should be, mm-hmm. and I thought, you know, again, I'm sort of dancing around the primary question, but it's really, you know, I don't think of novels, unless they're part of a series, unless it's Game of Thrones or something like that, where it's designed to continue and be serialized. I think a novel should be, especially, you know, you're spending, whatever, $20 on it, $22, whatever it costs, $15 on Amazon. but
nice.
Really, seriously.
Yeah.
But you should get a complete entertainment experience for that. You should
right.
you should get something that you feel like you've gotten everything you want from it. Unless you explicitly tell the readership that this is part one of 12 or whatever it's going to be. And this was not that. This is a complete thing. And so any questions that were left unanswered were left unanswered on purpose.
Okay. Great.
Now, which do you prefer more now, writing novels or comic books?
They're both pretty sweet, you know. Yeah. A novel is nice because I can completely craft the experience for the reader. Mm. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to deal with any. I mean, yeah, there are, like, the editor gives me notes, but it's different. Like, I've created the whole thing from start to finish. Like, I've written the whole, you know, the whole series, the whole maxi series is done, and then I give it to the editor, and then the editor might have some notes, and then I'll make some adjustments. But basically, it's that. It's also that, you know, I love the artists I work with. This is not a let's slam artists discussion. Get you guys. This is not that discussion.
I mean, it sounds like you're slamming artists.
No, I don't. Yeah. I'm not slamming artists.
Does it sound like that to you guys?
The artists are infuriated.
No,
right now.
The artists. Listen, the artists. I love you guys. Yeah. But you also, you know, sometimes the vision that you have for the way a particular panel or scene might be portrayed is not exactly how the artist sees it. And so you get something back, and then you, it's a collaborative effort in, you know, 99.9% of the time it's the best thing ever. But sometimes you're like, well, you know what? Damn it. I saw that slightly differently, and I would have portrayed it differently. And in novels, you get to complete, you're making all those calls. Like it is exactly how you want it to be. You bring moments up, you bring moments down. It's all the decisions you're making. Comics, you know, I'd like to think I've been doing it long enough that I can steer the artists in the way that, you know, toward the big moments. Like, this is the big moment on the page. This is the big moment in the issue, whatever. But it's, in knowledge, it's all under your hands. It's all up to you. Which also means you can screw it up.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have any support.
But the flip side of that must be true, too. Like, sometimes maybe you thought something should have gone a different way, and then an artist makes a choice. And you're like, oh my God, that's even better.
That's 1,000% true. Yeah. You have sort of it's not even a safety net. It's more like you have another source of inspiration that mm-hmm. isn't just your own mind. Yeah. You know, I do an image book called Curse Words, and
which is fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. And the whole point of that book almost is Ryan Brown and I inspiring each other in that way, like finding those moments for each other. You know, it's like a game of tennis. You know, I'll say, well, okay, there's this group of like, you know, if we had to design magicians from our world, like people who would hypothetically be wizards from this world, who would they be? And so he came up with like a technomancer, like a guy who has a laptop around his neck all the time. And he came up with a New York City fortune teller, just sort of a gal who's sort of throwing cards around all the time, and just a bunch of different stuff that and all I gave him was like, who would the wizards be from this world? And then he did it. And then now I've been able to take all those characters and make them into characters because I've seen his designs. There's the one that's like who's the guy who does the stunts in Vegas who like puts himself in a box?
Well, there's a couple. Are you talking about Chris Angel Mind Freak?
David Blaine?
Are you talking about Chris Blaine. Angel Mind Freak?
No, I'm not. I'm talking about David Blaine. Because Chris Angel Mind Freak is actually
Mind Freak. Nuts.
So what I did, actually, the truth is I conflated Chris Angel Mind Freak and David Blaine and turned them into a new character named Billy Rage. Who was in Curse Words. Yeah. But that's because Ryan drew a guy who looked kind of like one of those guys. He has, I don't know, it's funny.
Would you call him a douche?
I sure would. Yeah. I sure would. And the techno mage, whose name is Ronald, hates him. And he's like,
of course.
And he won't call him Billy Rage. He just calls him Billy. And Billy Rage gets really mad. He's like, my name is Billy Rage, goddammit. I told you, Ronald. And Ronald's like typing on his laptop. It's very great.
Yeah,
it's
there's
great
no
book.
Way Chris Angel doesn't introduce himself as Chris Angel Mind Freak everywhere.
Every single time.
Like his Starbucks coffee has Chris Angel Mind Freak written on the side.
But it's already there.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yep. Man, crazy.
Freaks my mind.
Definitely pick up the Oracle year, but since we're talking about Curse Words, one of the things that I think is really cool about that book is it started in the best way in a very silly place, mm-hmm. And it's grown deeper and more complicated over time. Was that Oral always part of the plan, or is that something you kind of discovered along the way?
I think, you know, we knew where we were going when we started. We knew that the basic idea of it. Which is based in, I mean, the main theme of Curse Words is, you know, what do you believe in? Like, what are the things that, the magic in our world are the things that we believe in, the things that we believe in against all reason, right? So like Santa Claus, or if you're religious, the church, or, you know, faith in government. These are things that we, like, belief is an engine in human society, right? It's the thing that we need, I think, as humanity. And so that's the theme of Curse Words, and But you don't start there, right? Like, what a drag, you know? Like, how does faith in government help human society move forward? Pre-order this book, please. You know, that's not great. And so you start with the crazy wizards and the talking koalas and things like that, and then eventually you move into the sort of the deeper themes. But it's like you hook them with the razzle dazzle, and then you bring in the sort of deeper stuff. But you don't stop the razzle dazzle. It's always still a blast.
Yeah, know? There's still people being turned into chairs and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a fun beat. That's Jacques Zach, the agent of Interpol.
Yeah. Well, I do want to talk about the deeper thing since you brought it up, the idea of the faith in government thing, because that's something.
Oh man, here we go.
Oh, come on.
Watch out.
Get ready to lose your shit. You're about to be mind freaked. Because that's a theme that's at least currently running through all of your work.
Yeah. Yep.
Why is that important to you, do you think?
It's a trap.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not FBI agents, so it's not a big deal.
And even if we were, could you trust them?
Yeah. Oh, freaked. Freaked my mind. You know, it's funny how themes emerge in stuff over time. I've always found presidents in particular very fascinating. We have a fascinating president right now, whether you know agree with him or not. He's certainly something we're all fascinated with.
We're definitely
we all
paying think about attention.
Him. That's right.
Twitter.com.
Yes, Twitter.com. So, you know, I think that we are extremely reliant, especially in America, on systems that we're not aware of and we don't understand.
Yeah.
And if you look at you know, a classic example to my mind is I had drinks with somebody recently who works at the Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy is their primary job is dealing with all of the nuclear sort of they kind of deal with America's nuclear waste among other things, and that's an extremely important job. But if you were like, what does the federal Department of Energy do? Because you know, your Con Ed bill in New York is a private company, basically. It's a utility company. All of your, you know, the electric bills all over the country are, it's like a business. So what the hell does the Department of Energy do? And if you had asked me before this administration, I would have said, well, maybe they like do, you know, PSAs about, you know, don't waste power or whatever. But the truth is they have this extraordinarily important role. And the only reason I know about it is because the Secretary of Energy that our current president appointed didn't know either, and he was going to shut him down. And then they had to call him up and be like, look, man, if you fire everybody here, then, it's like you can't do it. And I think that there are thousands and thousands of things across the country that are exactly like that. We don't know what our government does, but yet we place our faith in it, which I think is a fascinating thing, and it's ripe for stories. That's not the only thing I like to write about, but it's certainly part of it.
But because that really ties into Daredevil now, because you know Wilson Fisk is mayor of New York City, and that's an insane move. But yet here we are with our president, and it's one of those things where if you would have told me, like, oh, man, Charles Soule is going to write Daredevil and Wilson Fisk is going to be mayor, I'd be like, fuck that. That's ridiculous. No way that would happen. Now I'm like, wow, good choice. Very smart. I really like this. It's very interesting.
You got Pete to turn on the news.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, all right.
But, it's been an amazing you're doing an unbelievable job writing Daredevil. And it's crazy to see how these things are kind of coming up and so well done.
Yeah, I mean, Daredevil is a book that I'm a lawyer, right? I don't practice as much as I used to, but once a lawyer, always a lawyer.
I kind of am built for this book.
I was born for this book.
And also She-Hulk, too, which was fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you're completely blind as well.
I've been blind.
And I'll tell you what, I can't even tell.
Yes, well, you know, I did get hit radioactive waves, blah, blah.
Okay, cool.
So
because of Scott Pruitt.
Yes, yeah. Because of Scott Pruitt.
Oh, man. You had to throw that in there.
So Daredevil, yeah, I mean, for me, it was always about how do I take the legal background and incorporate it into the series in a way that hasn't been done before, but is also interesting. And I thought going political would be a really fascinating way. And I had that plan way before what happened happened. And then events kind of caught up with me a little bit. I mean, I was originally going to have a whole campaign. The original story was going to be Kingpin declares his candidacy. In the current story, Daredevil won a major legal victory at the Supreme Court, and when he was working in the DA's office, and he comes back to New York City, and he sort of goes on this adventure overseas to China. He's gone for several months. He comes back and finds out that the Kingpin has stolen the city that has become mayor. The original version of that story was, he wins the Supreme Court victory, and then the Kingpin declares his candidacy, and sort of the powers that be in New York come to Matt Murdock and say, listen, man, you're like the hero of the city right now because you won this victory at the Supreme Court. Can you run against him? And Daredevil says yes, against his better judgment, and so it's a whole campaign thing. But when that story would have hit in the Daredevil sort of publishing schedule, I think we were all just so sick of that idea.
And I would also argue that the Daredevil sort of waking up from his experience in China and coming back was like the election in America, where we were all like, oh, wait, what? we were like, we all thought it was going to go the other way, and all of a sudden Trump's president? Oh, fuck.
Yep.
What did we do? So I think that really reflects the time in a sort of a double way.
And I think it really worked effectively in the series, that was, but there was a whole, like, I didn't have it totally plotted, but I had beats in mind. Like, there was a beat where they were going to have a debate, like, they were going to have a televised debate. But a lot of those things made their way into the series. I mean, you saw them, the Mayor Fisk arc, to a degree. Yeah. There's a scene toward the end of the arc in Daredevil 600, where they have this kind of sort of philosophical debate with sledgehammers on the top of Belvedere Castle in Central Park, right? Yeah. But Kingpin needs his castle, so he's at Belvedere Castle, and it addressed some of the points that I was getting at. So I think, if comics is often about you have an idea and you can't use it, so you find a way to put it in someplace else, and that was certainly the campaign thing, but.
I also want to quickly say that Muse is an unbelievable villain. I've been really enjoying that.
Muse is
cool.
But
I'm really worried about what you're doing, Blindspot, because it's been heartbreaking, and I'm worried you're going to break our heart more.
Well, just keep reading. That's all I'd say. Just keep reading. That's the whole point, right?
You have to keep usually invested. In Daredevil comics, things turn out really nicely for Daredevil.
Yeah, they sure do.
So I'm the
next arc. I mean, Daredevil 600, but not for a little while. Can we spoil the ending of it?
So
at the end of Daredevil 600, the Kingpin, who's the mayor of New York City, gets shot up with like a zillion arrows. And it turns out that the Hand, that ninja clan, has come to New York City for various reasons that are explained in the comic, and has taken him out. And when that happens, Matt Murdock is the serving deputy mayor of New York City. And while the deputy mayor of New York City is not, it's not like vice president, you don't automatically become mayor. There's this weird sort of legal provision, that is actually on the books in New York that would allow it to happen. And
if the mayor is shot with a million arrows, the deputy mayor
becomes
mayor.
That's word for word. That's exactly how it goes.
He knows. Mm-hmm. He's, and so
when Daredevil 600 ends, Matt Murdock has been arrested by the police as Daredevil. He's handcuffed in the back of a New York City NYPD paddy wagon, and he hears with his super senses Matt Murdock is the mayor of New York City. So he is currently the serving mayor of New York. The Kingpin is off trying to deal with those arrows, I guess.
Bad case of arrows.
Yeah, it's tough, real tough. And so now Matt is going to have to figure out what to do next. And that's like when you finish, I wanted it to feel like an absolute landmark in Daredevil story.
Yeah.
And, Daredevil 600, right? And so.
Congratulations, you did it.
Sweet. Felt the way it was supposed to feel, I hope, right?
Yeah,
cool.
Sure.
Cool.
Well, let's talk about another landmark thing that you're working on. You're bringing back Wolverine to the Marvel
Universe.
This is 45 interlinked miniseries, something like that?
It's a lot. It's a lot.
There's a lot of stuff going on. What's the lay of the land? What went into the decision-making process to hit this so big?
Sure. Well, Wolverine is, I think you could argue whether it's Spider-Man or Wolverine, but he's arguably the biggest character at Marvel. Mm-hmm. And he's been dead for a while. Somebody wrote a book where he died.
We got to get that guy. We got to find that guy.
Get that guy.
If I was sitting on a stage with that guy,
I'd encase him in adamantium and leave him for dead.
Leave him for dead. So that was in 2014, the Death of Wolverine book that I wrote with Steve McNiven. Mm-hmm. And he stayed dead for a character at that level at Marvel, for
a
him to stay dead this long.
Surprising
amount of time. I've been very, very, I felt kind of good about that. Like it was a death that sticked. Was stuck. It death? It's stuck. Sticked. Stocked.
It's stuck. Stuked. It really sticked.
It's stooked. Yeah. So
who needs words, right?
Who needs them? We got artists. They can draw. So yeah, it was surprising. And then you know, I had vague ideas, like if it circles around again, what would I do? And they asked, which was kind of amazing. So you never know if you're going to get that job.
But so you planned it out. You're like, oh, if it circles around again.
In the broadest of broad strokes, like if I needed to,
saying the book's called The Oracle Year, and this all of a sudden all these amazing points just did Daredevil 600. He's now back at Wolverine after he killed Wolverine. I mean, it all seems very circular.
He's freaking out.
Pete had a lot of sugar before the show.
All right, so you know, for me, it was a chance to do the story that I thought would be. Yeah, you know, do the character justice. Like, you don't want to bring. I don't think you want to bring Wolverine back and have it be like, oh, you know, sort of with a whimper, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea is, I'm doing this really cool 40-page issue, which comes out in like a week or two, that Dave Marquez drew, which is gorgeous, and that is essentially how Wolverine gets out of the statue.
Wow.
But there's a million unanswered questions at the end of it. Like, what is? You know, what's happening? Like, what is he doing? Where is he? What's going on? And so then you branch out into these four miniseries, each of which is four issues. So, and I'm writing one, which is called Weapon Lost, which has Daredevil as kind of the main focus, as well as Frank McGee, Misty Knight, and Cypher, who's a very cool X-Men that I've always
Yeah.
Oh,
nice.
Oh,
I love Cypher.
No. Well,
that's a very cool X-Men. Oh,
no, that's not real.
Yeah,
no,
it's real.
And not only is he like,
Hold on. I'm retiring for the show.
Clearly.
I'm going to leave on a high point.
It is a high point because no one's ever uttered that name besides you on this in the world, really. Why would you say Cypher's a very cool X-Men?
Well, I'll tell you why. So each one of these four miniseries has its own sort of genre tone, right? Genre feel. Okay. And the one that I'm writing, Weapon Lost, is like a detective story, essentially. Great. Detective kind of noir thing. And so you have Daredevil, who I think is really the detective of the Marvel Universe, even though he's not really used that way very often. Frank McGee, who is a retired detective. Misty Knight, who is a retired police officer in New York. And then Cypher, right? So Cypher...
He's like a dictionary with legs.
No, he can speak any language.
Okay. Right?
But he's also an underused ability that he has is like figuring out codes and patterns. So he's like, did you ever see The Wire?
The television show?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So you know the guy, Freeman, right?
The Wire, the greatest television show of all time.
Of all time.
All right, yeah. I just wanted to give a context when you're talking about
So you know Freeman, right? The guy who made the little tiny like dollhouse furniture and stuff like that, but also is extremely skilled at figuring out codes and patterns and like figuring out kind of the underlying logic to the story that they're looking at. That's Cypher. And so you have this team that... is fantastic. I mean, Daredevil is the sort of surveillance guy because he can hear everything. Mm-hmm. You have Frank, who's kind of the muscle. You have Misty, who's also kind of the muscle. They're like the sort of the brawny sort of street level officers. And then you have Cypher, who's the codes guy. And so that to me is an incredible detective squad, and it works really well, especially the way that I've taken Cypher as a concept and reinvented him for today's readers.
Oh boy!
Exciting.
Well, you've
made one little boy very happy.
So that's Weapon Lost. But then we also have Adamantium Agenda, which is essentially that you remember the New Avengers book that Bendis wrote for a long time.
Yeah,
that Wolverine was on with Luke Cage and Iron Man and all that. So they are looking for Wolverine. And then you have an X-Men book, which is all of Wolverine's ladies. So it's Kitty Pryde and Storm and Jubilee and so on and so forth, who go to Madripoor to try and look for him. That's Mystery and Madripoor. And then the last one is some people who hate him, like Dokken, his son, Lady Deathstrike, Sabretooth. That's called Claws of the Killer, which is essentially a horror story.
Cool.
And they just don't want him to come back to life. So they're looking for him so they can kill him. So you have these four sort of, not teams, but they're sort of groups from different parts of the Marvel Universe who are all looking for Wolverine. And then they find things, which creates another picture or pattern. And then...
Which Cypher is good at.
He's really good at that.
It's amazing you're able to bring together the most popular character in the Marvel Universe with the least popular character in the Marvel Universe.
Oh, come on.
It's he's not the least popular
yeah,
character.
He's not a maggot.
You know what? Or he won't be for long.
Yeah. Way to reinvent Alex Zalbin's
life. I love this series. This is my favorite series of the year already.
I think I was writing, I wrote an entire issue of it today before this, and I think it's awesome. He's so good. And I want to tell you the thing that makes this so good, but just wait.
Can't wait. Mm-hmm. Very excited.
Yep.
Last thing, and then we'll move on. You're writing a couple of Star Wars books as well.
Yep, I am. It's yeah. crazy. I can't believe it.
I love the Poe Dameron book.
Thank you so much.
It's wonderful. I think, you know, we have obviously a little more Poe Dameron to go on now that we've seen The Last Jedi, but when you started writing the book, all we had was him, like, flying in and being like, cool, dude.
Nothing.
Goodbye. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm back now. You're cool. Goodbye.
I've got a jacket.
I love my jacket. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. So honestly, going into The Last Jedi, I felt like my main depiction of Poe was reading your comic book.
Yeah.
Do you feel like what you saw in The Last Jedi, did that change how you thought about him at all?
No, I honestly thought they'd been reading my comic is what it felt like to me.
Oh,
like,
nice.
You know, and they, you know what, they do. Like, it's all, Lucasfilm is awesome because they are completely aware of all of the pieces all the time, the story group. And so, you know, I didn't talk to Rian Johnson and say, hey, Rian, you know, this is what Poe's been up to. But story group does, and story group knows everything. And so they were like, well, you know, here are the things, and whatever he chose to incorporate, fair enough. But I think it was, it felt very of a piece with what I've been doing, which felt great. You know, I feel like I have Poe's voice kind of down, and it didn't feel any, you know, any different from the way Oscar Isaac portrays him or Rian Johnson or J.J. Abrams writes him. So I was really happy with it. I love that movie, actually.
And you're heading into new territory with Poe Dameron coming up, where it's starting to weave into The Force Awakens.
Yeah, that's right.
Jedi,
right. With issue 26, we finally move. The whole series so far, issues 1 through 25, has been set prior to The Force Awakens. And with issue 26 and beyond, we're moving into the events of Force Awakens and even Last Jedi, looking at them through the eyes of characters that we didn't necessarily see in the films.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah, and like the fact that I get to do this stuff, like there's a whole
dream.
It's really kind of amazing. You know, Star Wars is my, I mean, Marvel is probably my second primary mythology, you know, story-wise growing up, but Star Wars is the number one. And getting to tell stories based in it is just a constant, unending thrill.
Yeah. I'm very excited to read it. The other one that you're playing with is
Darth Vader. Man, the response to that series, you know, you never know. I was nervous when I took it because I didn't know if I wanted to write a book about somebody whose primary thing is murdering people. Like, that's all he does. It's like writing a book about Jason from Friday the 13th. But then I'm like, okay, that's what I'm doing. I'm writing a book about Friday the 13th. And so you make him somebody who barely talks, who you kind of understand what he is. And then you try and find little moments where you can reveal tiny bits of character for him.
Right, because the story is sort of, his story is already complete.
Yeah.
So you're finding the
little
nuance.
Nuggets of
well,
time.
One of the things that I really love about what you've been doing on this book that I feel like you almost take as a challenge is going back to the prequels and trying to redeem scenes themes and ideas.
I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I mean, the no moment at the end of episode 3 is like, it's not my favorite moment in context.
Right, yeah.
Like when it happened, I was like, "Oh, are you fucking kidding me?" Like,
no, I loved how small he was.
Yes,
I think everyone agrees how tiny he was.
All of the above. But then you take that and you think about what was happening, what was supposed to happen emotionally, what were we supposed to feel, and then you kind of you play with it a little bit, or the Anakin, I have the higher ground moment, and you play with that a little bit, and you try to reinvent it in a way that feels cool. So,
are we going to see Watto coming up, or are you going to reinvent him?
There's a place where Watto would fit perfectly, and I haven't decided if I'm going to do it or not yet. But I've thought about Watto.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he owned him. He was his
owner.
Like that's
he did.
No, I know.
Yeah,
it's just
I mean,
a funny
stuff
way
like
to
that,
put
like
it.
We you don't think about. That's why the prequels are perfect for mining because there's all this terrible shit in them that it's just kind of like, oh, here's the flappy dude. Who's a vague stereotype, you know, Watto with his chance
vague.
Cube. Okay, his very explicit stereotype.
Yes. Yeah.
And but you're like, this was a person who bought and paid for another sentient being and owned him and his mother for a long time. And, you know, and even stuff like Qui-Gon freed Anakin and didn't free his mom. Like there's a lot of weird stuff there that you can get drama out of.
Yeah.
Cool. That's a lot of stuff to check out. Anything else you want to plug, though?
No, that's a lot. Am I missing anything? No, that's everything. Astonishing X-Men. That's another book I do. Please check that out.
Book.
Thank you very much.
Very
we
fun.
Actually, we do a Legion podcast as well, so we end up talking about that a lot.
Shadow King because, and all that. Yeah. Kind of
is there any back and forth there?
There's no back and forth. It's just sort of synergy, but I love that. I love that show. The design of it is incredible.
So and I'll tell you what, it feels like the themes of this current season are very much
really,
like
really
Mind Killer
on par.
Virus. We were talking about Zorn a little bit. Like, feels interesting.
Yeah. So I've written, my run goes to 12 on Astonishing X-Men. It was always planned for that. I finished it. You know, I've written it all. It's being drawn now. It's almost all drawn. So you'll get to see how it all ends pretty soon.
Awesome. Right.
Very cool. Pick up all that stuff. Definitely pick up the Oracle Year.
Absolutely.
And also leave reviews on Amazon and Goodreads.
That's such a
right?
huge thing. Yeah. Amazon in particular, Goodreads. There's all these sort of algorithmic things that get triggered if you leave reviews. And if you like it, I mean, why not, right?
Yeah. That's great, though. Definitely pick it up. All right. There we go. Mic went down for a second.
Show's over.
Yeah, I think actually we're going to move to our next section, which is audience questions.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We're a little low on time, so we'll go out to you guys. Charles disappeared a little bit, but if you got a question for him or a question for any of us, you can just ask them. You, sir, right there. Did you have a question just for us?
Sorry.
That's not your fault.
My question was mainly actually for Charles, but I can ask it.
He's sitting right here.
Yeah. And, we talked about the differences between writing comics and prose, and comics is like you and the artist and that. And I was going to...
Go ahead.
See about, and of course this is a medium that you guys are familiar with, working with stage work.
Video
medium. Where you're now collaborating with a large number of people. And I was wondering if that was, in his case, maybe something he wants to add to his other,
saying expanding out from working with two people, or a couple people, down to one person, now going the other way into the blown-up universe. There's so much happening right now. this is all great. Let me field this one. I do think, as Charles was saying, I don't want to speak for him, but like the collaboration aspect is expanding outward, is adding more people, is more opinions all the time. And I feel like you do reach a far side of it where it's like, whoa, there are too many voices.
What was the
here.
Question? Do you want me to pretend to be Charles?
No. I'm doing a great job of that.
Yeah.
No, the question is about collaborating on a larger scale in like a stage work, or like I work in a writer's room where we're all collaborating sometimes with like 30 people trying to figure out what we're going to write for that day.
Yeah.
And that is, it's just like knowing when it's your turn to speak is tricky. So I feel like that is like the natural progression of it. Everything's fine.
We drank all of your beer while you were gone. Sorry about that.
Don't worry, we drank.
No,
it
got knocked over a little bit. We'll get you another one. I'm sorry.
But there's a question for you specifically, Charles, which is working, collaborating, like expanding out from working with a comic book team into working by yourself, but going the other way into working with a larger group, like to put on a production of a piece of work or something like that. Have you ever done that? How would that be for you? Are you interested in that?
You mean like, would I want to be part of a theater company?
No, like if one of your works was made into a play,
or if you were writing for that, much more larger collaborative situation.
Would that horrify you? Intrigue you?
No, I think it'd be great. I mean, I have the Oracle Year is option for television.
Cool.
And so that is in development now.
Nice.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's very exciting. I have another project that is. That I've never even talked about with anybody. With the guy I'm writing it with. But let me put it this way. The idea of writing things for television and film is part of what I would say is kind of the next phase of things I'm going to be working on.
Nice.
And so I'm excited about it. I hope that things happen the way that, I hope they do, which was kind of a stupid sentence. I hope things happen the way I hope they do. Yeah, there
very
you go.
Oracle year.
Very Oracle year. Very Oracle year. But it's. I'd be excited about it. I think one of the things that in particular I like about film and TV is the design departments where, it's let's visualize this idea in the to the nth degree, like to the furthest possible level, particularly on something like, you know, Star Wars film or the MCU films, like they'll take, like, the design elements of it are so important. So I'd love to work with, like, a real art department.
Well, a comic book script and a television script or movie script sort of have more in common than writing a novel, for sure, because you are, like, you're creating the a script is never the end product. You're just prepping for the next phase of production the same way a comic book is.
Yep, that's right. At the same time, I try to make my comic scripts very readable. So if you read a script of, you know, whatever, or particularly Curse Words is a letter I'm writing to Ryan Brown. You know, like, there's a lot of jokes and funny things just to make me and him laugh in a given script. There was a script early on where I sort of explained all of Star Wars to him to get one. Like, there was one beat where somebody was, like, swinging a stick. And so I'm like, well, this is similar to lightsabers in the film franchise Star Wars. And then I just went on for, like, four pages explaining all of Star Wars to him, which meant nothing because no one ever, it's not in the book. And he just, and he never even, like, I don't even think he mentioned it. So for all I know, he hates it. And I just do this stuff, and he doesn't like it very much.
But here's another fucking script for this guy.
Yeah,
this guy's got time to burn.
Well, the other thing that we do that I think is hilarious that I know for a fact he doesn't like is that... So he's a huge baseball fan, a gigantic baseball fan. I am aware of baseball, which is different. And so, but there's a very sort of underlying baseball theme to Curse Words, which has always been from the very beginning. And I put that in there because I know he likes baseball. The problem is, by just being aware of baseball and not really knowing baseball, I get a lot of things wrong.
Yeah.
And so he'll often tell me, well, this isn't how the... You know, what a shortstop does. I'll be like, well, it does in Curse Words.
Well, you battle him on his knowledge?
No, it's not a battle. It's like, this is what happens in Curse Words.
Wow.
And so he's...
That is frustrating.
Yeah, so he finds it very frustrating when I'm like, well, this is what's happening. Like, there's a point where somebody flips a coin... And in a baseball scenario, he's like, they don't flip coins in baseball. I'm like, well, they do in Curse Words.
Oh, man, what a jerk.
Yeah, so I'm the worst.
That's great.
That's what you really get fun. If you work with me. It's the best.
This is really going to pan out very well in the long run.
Because you were talking about you guys, we didn't get to... talked to you. We talked to you before you went on that road trip in the van.
Oh, the best. That was so good.
And we were like, oh, my God, that's insane. Like, how was that? That seems like such a fun thing to do, but also a nightmare. Like, how did that go?
It was a nightmare logistically to arrange because there were so many details.
Say for people that don't.
Sure. So I do the Image Book Curse Words. And last summer, to promote the book, because the thing about books... comics in particular is people stop talking about them, you know, and
not us.
Right. Not here. Every Tuesday. Right. But we wanted to do something to get the book back into the, you know, not that it ever really left the zeitgeist. It was always really at the forefront of comics, as we all know.
Yep.
But, you know, you just want to do things to get people, give a reason to talk about it, give a reason for the news outlets to cover it. Give a reason people to tweet about it, people to be excited about it. And also, Curse Words is a very, very fun book. Fun has been at the forefront of that experience from the beginning. So we decided we would get a van, and we would decorate it like 70s wizard van style, and we would drive around the country signing at comic book stores. And we did that for a month last summer. And it was awesome. We did 14 stores. We did 26 cities in 22 states.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was really... amazing, you know, because you go to every store was totally different, had a completely different character, which was interesting. Some guys, like, you know, there was most stores had a lot of people, had great turnout, which was fantastic. A couple of stores had terrible turnout, but the people there mysteriously had a stack of, like, you know, rare Darth Vader number one variants.
Oh,
right.
Wow.
And we arranged it so that, you know, you kind of had to, like, we had, you know, every store we signed at participated in the overall budget for the show. So, like, they kind of helped us out with the cost for different things. And so you're like, okay, this store probably just was like, you know, we'll handle our portion of the budget so we can get our Darth Vader 1 variant signed. And, you know, they brought you in. So, but that was rare. You know, that was only like, you know, one or two. Most of the time it was a very welcoming, amazing thing. And signing at Houston, and then you sign in like 2 weeks later in New Hampshire. Like, it's really, and you've driven there, right? You're driving all these places. So Ryan and I talked about we talked about everything. Like you're in a van for that many hours with a guy. I mean, the fact that we're still super close. We didn't know if we were going to be at the end of this thing, but we were and still are. But we did this sort of analysis about how much of our immediate field of view, because we sat in the front of the van, right? So like, what you're looking at is a blacktop in front of you, like the highway just stretching out in front of you. Like for either we were asleep or we were looking at blacktop for almost the entirety of a month. It was really weird because you'll go to a place, you'll sign for 3 hours, you'll go have dinner, and then you go to a hotel and you go to sleep. Wake up in the morning, get down the road, drive to the next place. So we spent almost a month staring at a highway, which was kind of a wild thing to do.
Drives you crazy.
That's nuts. All right, let's get
into it. Life is a highway.
Oh, shit. I bet you heard that song a couple times.
You, sir, right up there, why don't you come on down? We'll take your question real quick. All right. What's your name? What's your question?
Call me the Flash.
Wow.
Flash. All right, Pablo.
thanks, Pete. How you doing, sir?
Good, thanks.
It's been a while. I had just one unique question. Since you're going to soon to TV and film, I was wondering, what is the most unique concept you wanted to pull off on as far as movie and film?
Unique concept. That's kind of a big question, right? Because there's big visual questions, right? Like, you know, what's the biggest, craziest special effects sequence you could do? But also, what's the biggest story you could pull off conceptually that actually would still work as a show? It's this new thing that that I can't really tell you about. So that's a terrible answer. But I've been working on a new project that will have a comic book component to it, as well as hopefully TV. I mean, things are looking really good for the TV side of things. That is extremely socially, like super socially aware. It's like my stab at kind of putting something out into the world along with my partner, who, again, I can't tell you who it is. So this is the worst answer ever. But I'm working with somebody I really like. Click with creatively, and we are trying to do something that is about putting a type of project into the world that doesn't exist right now that really should.
Is it Dwayne the Rock Johnson?
It's a great guess.
He's ageless. That
guy's everywhere.
Because I look at him and I think, you know who would click with that guy? Charles Soule.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I think we'd be fine. I think we'd be okay.
Charles the Rock Soule. Yeah. Exactly. There you go. That has sort of been your nickname for a long time.
Charles the Stone. Soul.
Yeah, right.
Soul Stone. Wolverine has the Soul Stone.
I'm actually a Paper. Charles Paper. Rock Paper.
You're saying you beat Rock?
No, I'm not.
You heard it here first, folks. Charles Soul says he can take the Rock.
Yo, watch out for scissors, bro.
I'm worried about scissors. I don't know who scissors is going to be.
Cool. I do think we're going to have to move on, actually, to our next section, which is trivia. And for that, we're going to turn it over to Pleat LePage.
All right.
LePage, the star of trivia.
I hate how you say that now. All right. So this part, we give back to you, the lovely audience, an opportunity to win $25 free. Yes, you, first hand up guy.
Congratulations.
Come on down.
Be the co-star of trivia alongside the star of trivia.
Oh, wow.
Mr. Pleat LePage.
What is your name, sir?
My name is Sean.
Sean, audience, Sean.
Sean,
how this is going to work is today's trivia is on the Oracle year. So as long as you've read the book and know everything, you will get $25. So I'm going to read you a question, listen to all three possible answers, and make your best guess. All right, here we go. The main character, Will Dando, is a blank. Is it A, is he a bassist? Is he B, a mechanic, or is he C, a home wrecker? So it's either A.
It's A.
Yes, that is correct. He is a bassist.
Nice. Very good.
Word's getting out.
All right, question number two. Which friend helps Oracle set up a heavily guarded website? Is it A, Gramza, or is it B, Hamza, or is it C, Kwanza? So it's either A, or you could pick B.
B
is correct. Hamza is the friend in the book. Here we go. Last one. The Oracle gets a lot of enemies fast. Which one is not his enemy of these three choices? Is it A, a warlord with nukes? Is it B, a televangelist? Or is it C, Captain Bucky O'Hare? So, C, if you want $25. Yes, $25 is yours.
Well done.
Some crazy enemies in that book.
He studied it.
Yeah, he's read it at least five times, did you say?
Yeah.
Yes, he's nodding yes five times. He read it. Incredible.
You know, can I just say I wish you guys hadn't dumped up my beer on the floor.
Really?
Yeah. Sorry, that's what you get for leaving the stage. That's a longstanding punishment here at Comic Book Club.
Yeah, I got to say, you left it, then Pete just picked it up and just
dumped
watched.
It out on the floor.
It was like, fuck you. It was crazy rude. Guys, as we all know, tomorrow is New Comic Book Day. We recommend you go to Midtown Comics because they've been nice enough to sponsor the show. Pete, what are you looking forward to, my friend?
Oh, man, I'm going to go with Detective Comics. It's been insane, and I can't wait for more. Also, Thanos.
Great.
Oh, cool.
Justin, what about you?
What a great answer. I've just been reading X-Men Blue, catching up on that, and it's... it feels like there's so much going on in this book, all the X-Men books really, and I feel like I feel like we're about to lose these original X-Men. They're going to go back to their time soon. So take your time and enjoy them while you can.
Yeah, there you go. I'm looking forward to Domino Number 1 is coming out tomorrow. That's Gail Simone's big return to Marvel Comics.
Nice.
So excited to check that out. Also, I should mention, if you're listening to this in the podcast feed, we do a Wednesday morning podcast called The Stack that is available in the same Comic Book Club feed. And we're going to have a review of Domino there if you're listening to this, so check that out among many, many other titles, so that should be fun. Charles, plug your stuff again. What should people check out?
Well, the book that's out tomorrow for me is Darth Vader 14,
nice.
Which is the second issue of the Mon Cala arc, which is officially titled The Burning Seas, but I wanted to call it Mon Calamity.
Ooh, I like that.
But Lucasfilm, for some reason... said no.
This has a great cover. This is it's Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
inspired,
it is Apocalypse Now inspired. Also slightly Terminator inspired. Basically, it's sort of a sea stretching to the horizon, and then you have Darth Vader kind of rising out of it, like he's been underwater. So just his helmet is above the water, and his eyes are kind of glowing
this a
red.
On Twitter, I was upset when I saw that because I felt like his cape's going to get all wet, and it's just going to be draggy.
Yes,
but
exactly.
You said he has...
No. Vader has so many attachments. His suit is capable of many, many things, including it's got, like a hand dryer in the restroom.
Uh-huh.
It's got one of those in it.
Oh,
so
smart.
Cool.
Smart.
That's cool.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Plus, you could just breathe on it, I feel like, and I would also do the same
thing. Always leave my hands a little wet, though. The hand dryer.
Do you use the force blade thing? The thing where you kind of stick your hands
honestly,
in?
Honestly, I pretend. If people are in the bathroom, I pretend to use them, and I just wet my hands in my pants.
All right, fair
big
enough.
Window into JT's world.
And Oracle Year, Amazon, bookstores everywhere, right?
Everywhere. There's Audible, so there's an audio version if you like to prefer to listen
who
to your
reads
words.
It?
Pardon me?
Who reads it?
For a fellow named Charlie Thurston, who is excellent. Although, I couldn't get past, I don't know, 10 seconds of it because it felt so weird.
That another person was reading the words that have been in your head for so long?
Yeah. It's even weird to have have other human beings reading the words that have been in my, reading them in the book. But people seem to like it so far, so I guess I'll get over it.
That's awesome.
It's very cool. It's a great book. Definitely pick it up. A couple of other things before we go. Next week on the show, one of the original booth men who has made it good in the comic book industry is going to be back. Anthony Marquez will be our guest on the show.
He's the best.
Great. He's kicking off a new run on Vampirella with some really great art that is totally unlike him. So that should be a lot of fun to talk about. Also, our show is free to come see and free to listen to, but it does cost us a little bit of money to do. So patreon.com/comicbookclub. If you're listening at home, if you're here in the theater, we have a literal hat. There's a couple of other podcasts that we do. Riverdale After Dark, about the Riverdale show on
but
the
we
CW.
We do it after dark.
Yeah, we do it after dark. Pete loves doing it after dark. Also, we do a show called Inside Legion, as we mentioned, and After Krypton, which is a Krypton after show, all on their own feed, so please do check them out. Pete, what else do you want to plug?
Friend us on Facebook so you get to know about the amazing guests we have on our show.
Follow us on Twitter at Comic Book Live.
Check us out at comicbookclublive.com for the podcast and way more. A couple of people we want to thank before we go. We want to thank our fabulous interns, Iman Bell, Tom Radar, Craig Fletcher, Dave McKay, and Riley Trahan. We want to thank Charles for being on the show.
Yeah,
Boothman Prime. But most of all, we want to thank you guys. We're here every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Please tell your friends good night.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks
for coming out.
Thanks.
Really appreciate it.